Hey, 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 howdy everybody. Thanks for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And I've got a treat. I have got a new person in the studio with me today. Kyle is not here with me. It is Barista Kyle Filson in here today, not standard old podcasting Kyle Filson. It is Mr. I come in the studio with my coffee press
you like
and
that?
Almost spill it on things while I'm kicking it around over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I don't like the Keurigs or the Instant or the Sanka. I prefer to grind my coffee and then use a French press. That's true. I came in here today and remember I was
It's Barista Kyle Filson. He literally, folks, he comes in. He's got it. He's got his cup. He's got his French press. He's walked. He's like, hey, what's going on? And he hangs a toe right when he comes in a little bit. And it almost turns bad in a hurry.
Could you imagine the thousands of dollars I would have just flushed down the drain if I would have spilt that whole, you know, French press full of coffee all over that stuff?
And the thousands of dollars you'd have had to spend on dental work because I'd have beat your teeth out right over there in the corner of the studio.
Yeah, that's probably true, right?
How you been, Brad?
I've been great, man. Really good. Yeah.
I hope everybody had a wonderful weekend. Thank y'all for coming back here. We're going
to
have fun.
School's about to start. You know, the kids are getting ready for school.
Are your kids ready?
Yeah, they're ready to go.
My daughter's fired up.
Yeah, I say by the time the summer starts to wear down, they're ready to go back. And they got Little League Baseball starting up in like 2 weeks. So.
Yeah, you girls are expensive, man. It was one thing to send my son to school and all that stuff. You girls, y'all cost a lot when you got to go buy stuff for you women. There's so much stuff. You girls, look, I know y'all, there's a lot of girls out there that are high maintenance, and there's a lot of girls that aren't high maintenance. I get that, you know. I understand that. Some just more than other. But even those that aren't high maintenance are high maintenance. I mean, you women, y'all have to buy so much. I feel sorry for you. I really do.
Well, I understand what you're talking
about. You
got to
buy all the hair care products and makeup, and I want to make sure I look nice. And there's all this pressure on these women, especially young girls today. They want to fit that mold.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, don't fit that mold. A beautiful woman is a confident woman, period. That's it. There's no mold. Here's the mold. Be you.
Men are going to like you anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what you're saying. I feel bad for girls because my wife, it takes her like an hour to get ready. You know how long it takes me to get ready in the morning?
Yeah, I've seen you get ready in the morning.
5 minutes, maybe.
Maybe. Well, we know you don't have any hair to comb.
No, that's right. Well, and you were talking about buying school clothes and stuff for the kids. My older sons, Jacob and Caleb, they're just now starting to get to the age where they're starting to notice like name brands.
Where they want something in particular.
In particular. Up to this point, they've never asked. They've never cared. They just put something on and they go out the door. Now, for this first time, they're like, well, I want this. I want some Under Armour shirts. I want some DC shoes. You know, they're starting to pick out this stuff. And you're like, uh-oh, here it goes.
Here we go. Daddy's going to have to dig deep.
Remember when you used to wear your Z Cavariccis and you were a big Jerbo fan? I remember that when you were.
No. They didn't build them to fit me because I'm built like a bridge troll.
Yeah,
like a garden gnome.
I remember being caught up in that game, though, as a teenager. Yeah. You're like, oh, man, I got to have this. I got to have that. You got to be, or you're just a loser.
Yeah, so if there's any people listening to this that are in school and going through this, young folks and stuff, don't get caught up in all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a waste of time.
It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. And ladies, if there's any of you lovely ladies out there listening whose man, you've got a man in your life right now, and he's like, well, you got to get all fixed up before we go anything, or you look like this, get rid of that joker. Kick that fool out. You don't need that in your life. You don't need that. Just be yourself. That's the problem. Women are always like, well, there's this. It's because you're not messing with men. You're messing with boys. Get rid of them. If they're that picky, you don't need them. You can do better in your life. But I tell you what you can't do, and Kyle's going to love this part. You can't dismiss the dangers of killer robots so quickly.
Oh, here we go.
Gotcha. Cue the Terminator. Cue the Terminator music. This is from IO9. This is from Mr. Toby Walsh. And Toby actually wrote about this. Now, look, we've covered this before. That earlier in the summer, we talked about them. There was a whole bunch of people had signed, like thousands of them, had signed a letter. Remember we talked about the open letter?
Yes, I remember that.
They wanted to ban autonomous killing machines.
I signed that letter, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. And Toby explains this. He says, in an open letter I helped publish on July 28th, which has now been signed by more than 2,700 AI and robotics researchers from around the world, we stated that starting a military AI arms race is a bad idea and should be prevented by a ban on offensive autonomous weapons by meaningful human control. Now, after that was done, there was a philosopher named Jay Gallant. And he had actually challenged this notion of a ban, and he recommended that they welcome offensive autonomous weapons, or what you and I refer to and even referred to in this, and everyone else that I know refers to them as killer robots.
Why would he be for that?
Because I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. Now, here's some points that Jay brings up that's in this article. He puts forward four arguments why the ban on this is not needed. One is no robot can really kill without human intervention. Okay. Now, what he's talking about is like a drone robot. He's not talking about, you know,
a human controlling it. Yeah.
He says, two, we already have weapons of that kind for which a ban is sought. So I guess he's talking, maybe he's one of the guys, he wants to ban some firearms. Who knows? Now, number three, he says the real worry is the development of sentient robots. And also, he says that UN bans are virtually useless.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
On a sentient robot, it doesn't matter what the ban is. The robot's doing whatever it wants to do.
Do you remember, I'm going to read you this right here from the Handbook of Robotics, the 56th edition, 2058 AD, iRobot. Law 1 is a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Law 2 is a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except when it conflicts with the first law. Law 3, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. That's great and all until it thinks for itself. Because what happens in the movies? Bump, bump, bump.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. Has the guy not seen Terminator 2? They talk about it.
What about iRobot when it goes crazy? Look at all the robot movies. Name me one robot movie that where everything works out peachy. Wall-E?
Yeah, maybe.
And that's because it's Disney.
Or what's the Short Circuit?
Johnny Five is alive. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
But you're 100% right. Has the guy not been paying attention? That's what happens in the movie of Terminator. Yes. Cyberdyne becomes self-aware, and it only takes it like 20 days till it starts eradicating human beings.
Yeah, once it starts rolling
That's
through.
My fear, even though I do have my button.
I've got my button right here.
So I should
be
safe.
Oh, it's missing. Well, I brought all this
They're
up.
They're in the safe over there.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I'm going to have it implanted under my skin.
My bug out bag has one in it, too.
Right on the outside?
Not for my whole family. It's got one for me.
That's right. I'm worried about me.
Yeah, I could probably start over. I'd be okay with that.
Oh, God. The reason I brought it up was because I know it gets under Kyle's skin, but if you get on VentureBeat.com, he's going to enjoy this because I haven't sent him this, folks, but I'm going to. There's a video out right now, Philly, that Boston Dynamics has posted.
Of course.
And it's the robot going for a walk in the woods. Now, of course, we always talk about it. Mark Relbert is the founder of Boston Dynamics, talked about and showed this footage during a talk on August 3rd at the 11th Fab Lab Conference and Symposium in Cambridge, Mass. This is what he says. Out in the world is just a totally different challenge than the lab. And he says that at the conference, of course, we were talking about, you can't predict what it's going to be like. Basically, it's showing the robot that you and I have discussed this whole time traipsing around down a trail. Now, it's dragging a cord, mind you, okay? You know, it's not like it's got the battery pack on its back and it's just kicking around.
Right.
It's dragging this cord behind it. But if you watch this video, and folks, if you just go like on YouTube or whatnot, you can even go to VentureBeat, but if you search up like Boston Dynamics, the Atlas, or just Atlas robot tested outside. If you Google search Atlas robot tested outside, you can see it. It's disturbing because what have we been discussing? Our second episode ever of Expanded Perspectives, we discussed this stuff.
Yeah.
Not even 2 years ago. And this is now they're outside. They're testing these things out. They're letting them run around.
Oh, this is what you're seeing.
That's what they're showing. Not what R&D's working on. This is what they're showing us. So for all we know, this is the smoke and mirrors. This is the window dressing. And they're like, this is all we got. Don't worry about it.
Disinformation. I agree with you. Yeah. I think that they show these things deliberately to show you, like, this is what we've come up with. Not telling you that they're 50 years ahead of that.
I mean, the video, the wild thing is I talked about the dog. Remember the DARPA dog that we talked about in the DARPA cheetah? In the video, they show the DARPA dog that's got a head on it that looks like it's got the face is like an operating claw.
Yeah.
It'll walk up to a door. It unlocks the door. In the lab, they actually have the old school Atlas robot walking across rocks. And the first thing in that video it reminds you of is the Terminators in the very first one walking across skulls. That's what it looks like. It's walking across uneven rocks. It's not falling. And the robot's arms are out at its side, and it's using its balance as it's walking. It's balancing itself.
Well, what's the curious thing about all those videos? They don't put a head on it. And the reason why they don't put a head on it is what would you think if they put a head on it?
Well, then that's when you freak out.
It'd look like the Terminator.
I'd want to take a pickaxe to the battery power. That's what I'd want to do.
I think that's what we're creating. Look, I know we mention it all the time.
We do, because it's unnerving.
Jokingly, but it's not really a joke.
But see, we're all witnessing this take place right now. This is history being made that in 100 years or in 50 more years, your grandchildren might be like, might be old maybe, and under the control or the society ran by this, and they may be like, my grandparents told me about when they first started witnessing this. Because you don't think that your grandparents or great-grandparents would have told you that they've never seen a car, and now they witness what it looks like now, and now they witness the tightness that the oil and gas companies have on our wallets and on what we do every day? It could go down the same road.
Yeah.
This is our version of the car. I remember back before there was a car, we had horses. Well, I remember back before we had robots.
Before cell phones, all that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm not cool with this. I mean, call me crazy, call me whatever you want to. I'm not cool with this, man.
Moving on to archaeology. Did you see this? The remains of an ancient female warrior still clasping a huge sword and dagger have been discovered in the south of Kazakhstan. Now, they're calling her Red Sonja.
Yeah, really?
That's what they're nicknaming her. You know,
first of all, folks, here's what's crazy. I bet Kyle's got 6 copies of that video.
What are you?
Some of them are
about?
Unopened. The dude loves it. He can play it off right now, but since we were children, he has loved that show. He's had the hots for Red Sonja since I don't know. He's like 12.
What was the girl that played that?
I don't know. You're the stalker.
Bridget Nielsen.
He actually sent her a letter when he was a child to get an autographed picture of it. I think he still has it.
Anyways, this woman, that's the bones of this woman that were discovered there in Kazakhstan. They believe that she was the leader of this nomadic nation of warriors, and that they found her body. It's pretty cool. I mean, she's been buried. She's got weapons all over. I mean, she has a dagger, a sword, a knife. They said a collection of some loose change and things like that. And they believe that she was the head of this nomadic tribe and that these tribes in this area actually battled with the Hun at that time.
Well, I got a question.
Sure.
We already know that in certain societies, women weren't given the same level as men. And then we know in certain societies.
That,
exactly.
Yeah.
What does that tell you about this group? If they buried a woman with a lot of weapons, weapons weren't just like what we come along today whenever you just get tools. You don't just go to the store and pick them up. They were prized possessions. So I wonder if they were hers. Were they all of her weapons? Or were they actually put in by the people that she served with?
Well, she's still clasping them.
So, see, they were hers then.
Yeah,
she's
gangster.
Yeah.
She was fighting.
Straight up then, yeah. And worth a lot of money.
Wasn't the status quo. This chick was a fighter.
Like, she's like the Ronda Rousey type old gal.
Exactly.
She is. I got
they dubbed
you.
Her Red Sonja.
The alpha female.
Anyways, they've been excavating this, and they said that all the things will be on exhibit at the National Museum of Kazakhstan soon. So we'll be checking in with that. Hopefully they'll put some more pictures up, because right now it just looks like a skeleton on the ground.
I can't wait till they get it all exhumed, because I want to see it. I want to see all the pictures of all the weapons like laid out. You know how they like lay them all out of what all they find?
Yeah, maybe it's an Ulfbert.
Because I keep thinking of just like one of those Pirates of the Caribbeans, and whenever they got the chick, and they're like, you know, you can't go in there to see Chow Yun Fat or whoever it is that's in there, because you got to take all your guns out and stuff, and she just pulling all these weapons out, and they're stacking up. That's what I picture this chick's like.
Speaking of weapons, I'd like to ask you, if you could, of all the ancient weapons, which one is your favorite?
Hmm.
I'm talking all realms, European, Asian.
Man, that's a tough question.
What is your favorite weapon?
My favorite weapon. I was still going to, I'm going to have to say a bow just because of the, just the way it is. Just a handmade bow. The Ulfbert sword is amazing and all that. But as far as just a weapon in and of itself, I'm just an archery junkie and I've always been. So it's always going to be something that I enjoy the most, I believe.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really have an answer. I don't know.
What is yours, like a mace? Is that what yours is?
I don't know. What is the long, is it the Naginata?
Oh, here we go. Yeah. Blade on I thought you liked the one that had the three section staff. You liked that. You were real good at that.
Anyways, we saw one of those at Trader's Village the other day with the twins. They're like,
it's a big flea market, folks. It's a huge flea market.
So I had to find some old Kung Fu movies where they were using it. And once I showed that to the twins, they loved it.
You didn't get them on, did you?
No. So you crazy?
Yeah, I don't want to get the hell beat out of me again.
Well, let's take a break, folks. When we get back, we're going to get into some more archaeology. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam?
Yes, sir.
I know that from time to time we like to do a little archaeology. Mm-hmm. You know, and lately we've been doing a lot of ghost stories and things like that.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Folks, we're not doing the archaeology. We just like to read about it. We're not digging a hole in anything.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we're always fascinated, and me, myself included, about pre-Columbian things. Now, we talk about different things, whether it's the Arizona artifacts, whether it's the Kensington Runestone, the Decalogue Stone, the Back Creek Stone, the Spirit Stone, the Narragansett Stone, the Hevner Runestone. There's one little thing, and it takes place in Rhode Island, that I've always been interested in. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about who is reported to have built the thing. Or was it just simply a windmill?
Mm-hmm.
I've always been fascinated by the Newport Tower, and I know that you've been digging, and you're an expert on it. What can you tell the listeners about the Newport Tower?
First, an expert. I ought to slap you with this going on. It is one of those things. I'll tell you what got me down this, because it's funny how these segments always seem to grow legs out of the blue whenever we start talking about stuff. But what started this whole thing was, I'm sure everybody out there, all your listeners, everybody out there has done this at one time or another. You've heard of something, and then you've seen a few shows over something, and you don't look into it anymore, and then somebody asks you something about it, and then you kind of parrot off the thing like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
When really you don't know anything about it, but what you maybe have seen on TV or read in a news article, and that's really about it. And everybody's guilty of it, and Kyle and I are no different than y'all. I mean, just because we do this show and we dig in a lot of these subjects doesn't mean that we know all these subjects. I mean, it doesn't mean that we have any more knowledge about anything than any one of you listening.
Absolutely.
All it means is that when we find something, we read in and we really look into it. Well, that's what happened to me on this Newport Tower. A friend of mine came up and had seen it on television. Oh, I forgot. A couple weeks ago. Come and asked me about it. And I just kind of spat it off, you know. And then they were like, well, that's not what this thing said. And I'm like, what? And then so we got to talking about it. And then I realized that I knew very little about the tower outside of what I had seen on television. Is, oh, you know, maybe it's just Norse. Maybe it's old. Maybe it's. So I wanted to look into it. I wanted to kind of familiarize myself and not just be talking out of my butt on this whole thing. So if you go, we'll start off with this, folks. If you just jump Wikipedia, here's the very first little line of it. And it says the Newport Tower. They also call it the Round Tower, the Touro Tower, the Newport Stone Tower, or an old stone mill. And basically, it's just that. It's located in Touro Park in Newport, Rhode Island. And it's that. It's a round stone tower. Now, there's a lot of theories that go around who built this. Now, what the wiki has on is that they believe that it was a windmill that was built in the mid-17th
That's what I've
century.
Heard, yeah.
Yeah. And it's basically, it's the bottom half of the windmill. But then there's also some things, some speculation that's gone around that it was pre-Columbian and that it was showing that they had been Norse and things that had landed over here. And, of course, it's not very widely accepted. So we're going to get into some of these theories right quick. Now, here's the first one. The first one is the Benedict Arnold theory. And this would be in, let's see, in his will in 1677, then the governor of Rhode Island, Benedict Arnold, which was at that time, Benedict Arnold is the great, great, great grandfather of the traitor, Benedict Arnold. He refers to the tower and the will as my stone built windmill. Okay.
Okay.
Which is pretty strange. In his will, it's written my stone built windmill. Now the Viking theory was in 1837, and there is a Charles Raffin of Denmark, and he proposed that the tower was built by Vikings, actually of Scandinavian descent, in around 950 AD. Then there's a Portuguese theory that Edmund D. Del Barra and Dr. Manuel da Silva, they believe the tower was built as a church watchtower by early Portuguese navigator Miguel Corte Real around 1500. Now there's even a Chinese theory, Philly.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, and it's a historian, a British fella named Gavin Menzies, and they claim that the tower was built by a Chinese navigator, Zheng He, in 1421. And then, of course, there's one that is pretty cool, and it's the Knights Templar theory. And they believe that it was built by the Scottish Earl Henry Sinclair and during an expedition led by Antonio Zeno in 1398.
I've heard that. When they escaped persecution, they fled to the new land. And they developed and built this tower along with some other structures. Yeah. Very interesting.
So we're going to jump into some of that. Now, like I told you, as most modern historians today accept that the tower is simply the remains of an old stone windmill built in colonial times by Benedict Arnold, like I said, the great-great-great-grandfather of Revolutionary War, patriot, and, of course, traitor under the same name. At the time, Arnold was governor of Rhode Island, and he had owned the land where the tower is now located, or where it was built. Now, himself, like I told you, he mentions the structure in his will, that he calls it my stone-built windmill. And later on, there's records that show that it was used as a lookout tower by the Americans and an armory by the British during the Revolution. Mm-hmm. So it's been involved in American history. Now, the design of this mill, folks that y'all haven't seen it, if you want to look it up, looks like a cylinder supported by columns. And, you know, it's kind of got the archways and the different columns that go around it. Now, it's very similar if you just search up Chesterton Windmill in Warwickshire in England. Warwickshire. There's actually a story. This is how it goes, that when Arnold saw this Chesterton Windmill as a child, and then whenever he was older, he duplicated the design and built his own stone windmill after he had immigrated to America. Now, I don't know about y'all, but when I read that, first of all, I'm going to throw up air quotes right quick. I've seen a lot of stuff when I was a child, as you have. I don't know that I could have built anything quite as accurate and exact from my memory as a child in another country before I got over here. This isn't, you know, that he probably didn't have photographs and drawings and all this stuff of it. But so, because you'll be surprised at how much it looks like this Chesterton windmill.
It's an exact replica.
It looks like it, yeah.
I mean, there's absolutely no... He definitely did have photographs. I mean, there's no way.
Yeah, exactly.
But to build it in the same style, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, it's a perfect representation.
It's almost more than luck, right? It's almost more than what you would think, especially as a child. So let's jump to 1990 now. All right, boom. That's where the construction date of the Newport Tower at that time was estimated, like I said, between 1635 and 1698. Now, they based that on carbon-14 dating of the mortar in those stones. Now, this is true. It would just about perfectly fit that time frame of Arnold that would have built the tower if he's the one that built it. Now, we're going to switch gears like we like to do here, and we're going to leave that there. We're going to go into this Norse theory. Now, theories that the tower might be something more than Arnold's mill, like I said earlier, started back around 1837, because that was the year that there's a Danish archaeologist, and like I told you, his name's Christian Raffin. He wrote a book, and in the book, it's called Antiquitates Americana. Now, in that book, he proposed that the Vikings had explored the coast of North America centuries before Columbus, and he was particularly interested in that book about the Norse trips to what was called Vinland.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've covered Vinland. You know, we've talked about that in the old Norse settlement there. But anyway, Raffin believed at the time, he believed that it must have been there in New England and that he had studied some strange markings found on Dighton Rock and also had come to the conclusion that those markings were Scandinavian origin. And of course, that in turn led him to believe that the Newport Tower was originally part of a Norse settlement. Now, his ideas about the Norse origin of the tower, and also he was extremely persuasive in the way he told the story, told it to a friend of his that happened to be a poet named Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And he actually included that in a Viking ballad he wrote called The Skeleton in Armor. And, of course, even though it's a poem and even though it's a fictional poem, it really at the time helped popularize the idea that the Norse people built this tower, which, you know, it's almost kind of like a movie star or a very popular musician putting their stamp of approval on something.
Yeah.
Doesn't really mean anything one way or the other, but people do it now. You know, they do it now. So that's almost like having a commercial done for your theory. Now you're going to have to go over 100 years later, 1942, at the fact there was a fella, trained archaeologist, all right, a very dedicated archaeologist named Philip Answorth Means, and he actually published his own book about the Newport Tower, called The Newport Tower, and he took up Raffin's, basically took the lead and went from there. Now, Philip himself believed the tower resembled round churches that were found in Scandinavia, and he suggested that Arnold simply converted an already existing structure into a windmill rather than building the tower from the ground up. And he listed a whole number of reasons. Now, not all of them quite had, you know, a lot of merit, a lot of stuff behind it, but I'm going to give you an example. Mr. Means there, he said that, contended that the existence of a fireplace, they know there's a fireplace, was in it. And there's the remains of which can be seen on the upper floor of the tower there,
mm-hmm.
shows that the original building was not constructed as a mill, because he argues that the operation of a mill would generate too much flammable dust. And we've talked about the flammable dust that they think they found in that Scott had found in the
pyramids,
the Great Pyramids. Exactly.
Right, yeah.
And that if you'd put a fireplace in there, you're going to ignite it. You're going to have problems. Now, logically, that makes sense. You're like, it's okay. It can't. Well, but it doesn't, because there's numerous examples throughout Europe that there were fireplaces installed inside mills, because while you're working there, you got to keep them warm.
Right. Yeah.
So they were certain. Now, the type of fireplace installed in most of these windmills is also very similar to the fireplace there in the Newport Tower, because the flue actually exits through the sidewall, because it can't go through the roof, since the tops of the windmills were designed so the blades could turn and they have to rotate to face the wind.
Right.
So basically, a regular fireplace up by the roof wouldn't just be a practical thing. You just really couldn't do it. Now, Philip was also very dismissive of the comparison of the Newport Tower to the Chesterton Mill, and he said because there was some work done by British historian Rex Wales. Now, Wales was under the opinion that the Chesterton windmill itself had been originally built as an observatory and converted to a windmill again after Arnold left for America. So he actually believed that the one that everybody's basing it off of wasn't even a windmill at the time he saw it, that Arnold saw it, that it was basically an observatory. Well, there's now some more recent research that says that the Chesterton was always a mill, and it's entirely plausible that Arnold, or even some member of the Newport community who may have helped him out, you think about that, could have seen it before they traveled over here to North America, and then they duplicated the design of it. So it may not have been Arnold. Maybe he didn't have that idea of it.
Right.
Maybe somebody else that he had that was a better builder, that somebody that came along. Now, the Norse theory doesn't really lose its legs there. Okay, now check this out. Now, only 4 years after Means' book came out, there were two professors, a P. Lovefold and a Mr. M. Jorndal. And they found what appeared to be a Swedish or Norwegian runic inscription on the west side of the tower, about 14 feet above the ground. And the inscription had a date on it also.
Really?
10-10.
Wow.
10-10.
So how do you argue with that?
Well, when I read this, I got fired up. I'm like, there it is. Done. Maybe, you know, we're wrong. That's it. It's runic. But there's some proof. But there's a very big problem with the validity, because here's why. The number of years involved since the theory came out in 1837 to the discovery of the rune is 2 or 4 years. 2 to 4 years isn't how long before they found all this, okay?
Right.
That makes it very possible that it's part of a hoax and that it was put in there to kind of help back that up, that somebody may have been a proponent. And they went there, and they knew they couldn't do it at head level because everybody would have been like, well, that wasn't there before. So they climbed up on kind of an obscure side, and they may have carved it in and then not said anything, let it set a few years in the weathering, you know, just enough to make it not look fresh, because right, they didn't have what we have in order to test it. They just have to go off the looks and maybe the edges, you know, who knows? But it does kind of make you go, wait a second. You guys have crawled all over this thing. You've, you know, allegedly looked all of it, this whole thing. I don't know how well it was really looked into. Then they just now find it out of the blue. It's like Vice just finding the carving inside the Great Pyramid that everybody's been through, and just so happens he finds it and it's misspelled. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of, you smell that, it smells a little BS-y whenever you start looking at that. So you're like, okay. But it crushed me because I was like, almost there, you know.
Well, that's one of the neatest things about the tower is no one really knows who the heck built it.
You're right.
I mean, everybody is there. It's like, no, it was here when we got here. No, it was here when we got here. So who the hell built it?
Well, here's another one from Norse. Like I told you earlier, Portuguese or Chinese. In the early 20th century, there's a historian, Edmund de la Barre, now proposed this, that the tower, like I told you, was constructed earlier by a Portuguese navigator, Miguel Real. Now, I believe that Real, de la Barre, believe that Real had actually been shipwrecked in that area around 1501 or 1502. At the time, he was searching in Narragansett Bay for his lost brother, Gaspar. That's what he was doing there. Now, there's several supporters at the time of this Portuguese theory, and they pointed to a large number of what they said was octagonal rotundas, particularly in the main tower of the castle of Tomar. And that is actually found there in Portugal. And I looked at them, and they bear some resemblance to the Newport Tower. I mean, you could make that argument, you know, maybe you could just build it this side or the other. Now, there's another theory that come along was very interesting, because you and I have talked about this before. There's a book that was written, like I told you, by Gavin Menzies, and it's called 1421, The Year China Discovered the World. And in there, he argues that there's ships from a Chinese fleet from Admiral Zheng He that circumnavigated the world, and they believe that that fleet is who constructed Newport, the Newport Tower. In there, Gavin writes that, like, of course, you know, here's what's funny when he's talking about it. Like a lot of the out-of-the-box thinkers that we all talk about and that we cover and all this, and fringe writers, his theory is really extremely controversial and not very well accepted among mainstream scientists. But either way, you've got to kind of look at it. You got to take a look at, like we've always talked about, you got to look at everything. You can't just go in there going, this is how it is. You got to look at his theory on it, the whole deal. So like we talked about, so who built it? Like you just ask. All right, so was it Benedict Arnold that built it? Was it Vikings? Was it Miguel Real? Was it the Admiral Hay?
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese man you're talking about, I thought Magellan was the first person to circumnavigate the world in like 1519. Yeah. Is that not correct?
No. Yeah.
Right?
The only theory so far that I found, and so far that comes through that you can really have some evidence that backs it up, is the Benedict Arnold theory. And here's why. There was excavations in and around the tower, and they've unearthed only artifacts consistent with the colonial period. No Norse artifacts, no Portuguese, no Chinese. Now, okay, look. There's critics of this Arnold theory point all this out, that the lack of pre-Columbian and pre-colonial and all this objects doesn't prove that the building itself isn't much older.
Right.
Okay, but it is hard to believe that during the construction that it could actually predated the colonial pillar, that builders wouldn't have left tools or construction material or anything that the archaeologists couldn't find. And they also argue that the time of the construction of this thing, that the colony at Newport would have been preoccupied defending themselves against the attacks between them and the Native Americans. Now, stating that these people would not and could not have taken on such an intensive project, such as a very simple stone windmill tower.
Yeah.
Now, you're kind of thinking, well, why would it? Now, while this tower, of course, is undoubtedly way more difficult to build than a wooden one, I mean, you're talking about nailing it together as far as toting stones, butter and stones and all that. They brought this up. Well, maybe the storm destroyed the earlier wooden version. And rebuilding a stronger version is what Arnold thought, you know, let's invest some work and let's build one that'll last. Yeah. Maybe that's what he thought. Now we're going to toss up this, and we're going to throw a little Occam's razor out there, you know, is the simplest answer is always the right answer if you go look at that. The construction of this tower would have been a challenge for the colonists at the time, the people there. But wouldn't it have been just as difficult or even more difficult than the groups mentioned before and all the theories I just talked about?
Absolutely.
I mean, why would Real bother building a signal tower out of stone if the Portuguese fellow is the one that built it? Why, if he had wood?
Yeah.
You know, why would you go to that much trouble to build that unless, of course, it was a marker? Now, here's something that's interesting. You're going to like this. In 1995, there's a professor of astronomy at the University of Rhode Island named William Penhallow. And you talked to me about this when you asked me this before we got on air. Penhallow is the fellow that discovered several different astronomical alignments in that tower.
Well, that's what I think is so interesting is whoever built it, they had a good understanding of astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard stories where if you align this with this, that the tower actually points all the way to the Kensington Runestone as like a landmarker. It points to other parts on the globe. That ancient Egyptians, even there was a carving somewhere that referenced mm-hmm. the Newport Tower, that this thing's been long there. It was like a marker. It was like almost like a land surveying marker stone.
It could point to all different things. It did yes. it all together. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. On the first floor on the room of the tower, it has three windows, a northeast window, the south window, the west window. Now, based on the clues that Penhallow suggested, that the tower acted like a grand timekeeping device, kind of like a sundial. The first floor room of the tower was a solar disk, is what they call it. And they call it a camera obscura or a calendar room. The movement of the solar disk, or like we said, the image of the sun, inside a camera obscura is like the movement on the tip of a shadow on the sundial, okay?
Right.
So this kind of calendar was actually used by astronomers of the Renaissance, especially in Italy and in Northern Europe. All right. Now, Penhallow predicted this, that on December 25th of 1996, the full moon would be visible if you looked through the west window, through the first floor room, and out the northeast window. Well, they went there. He was right. It's exactly where it went. Now, the interesting thing about that is because the moon's lunar major, lunar minor cycle, it will not happen again from that point till 18.6 years later. He also predicted that on the winter solstice, that the sun would be visible if you look through the west window, through the first floor room, and out the south window, looking up through them.
Right.
He was right again. Well, so Mr. Godfrey, there was a William S. Godfrey Jr. Now, he was a very thorough archaeologist. He conducted a dig around that tower early in the 50s, and he published his findings in American Antiquity, and it was published in 1957. And he had went around, you know, around the sidewalks and everything there and actually took them out, lifted the sidewalk, took everything out to get down into the soil, into the layers of the soil, what he called sterile layers, where it was nothing done.
Okay.
Now, this is a description of what he found in the soil surrounding it. We cleared the area with great care, but found the yellow clay, as before, completely undisturbed. No sign of foundations, no post holes, no Norse artifacts. Instead, though, this is what he found: pottery shards, iron nails, clay tobacco pipes, buttons and buckles, all traceable, you ready? England, Scotland, or the English colonies in America. All were dated between the 17th and 19th century, and he even found a preserved boot print in the soil beneath the stone foundation.
Wow, how the heck do you even do that?
I guess it had stepped down, and when they laid a stone on top of it,
it just preserved
it. It didn't mash down. It just sat on it. And then what was underneath it, the little void, maybe it stayed there.
That's incredible.
Now, in 06 and 07, there was a research foundation, the Chrononostic Research Foundation, sponsored a trip to the Newport Tower. They used some different techniques, of course, that wouldn't have been available in the 50s. They used GPR, some ground penetrating radar. They identified a lot of the history of the park, and they increased the amount of 17th, 18th, and 19th century artifacts found around the tower, in turn backing up Godfrey's findings. Now, there's also some ideas, too, that are attached to a Scotsman, Henry Sinclair.
I've heard this.
Yeah, and they think that maybe he had something to do with it while exploring the North American coast in 1395 and 1398, because they believe that he was actually part of a planned community, that he was actually trying to build something there. still, though, even after the Sinclair thing and all these other theories, the hard facts point to that the Newport Tower was probably built in the 17th century by Governor Benedict Arnold and was more than likely modeled after Chesterton Windmill. Now, of course, like I said, all that was great. Everything was cool. That's kind of what we found until in the last couple of years. There's a whole other can of worms opened up because of this alignment structure. The stuff you're talking about.
The astrological alignments.
They're looking at Masonic ties now. Because you've got to imagine, you would think maybe Benedict Arnold wasn't a Mason. Or if he wasn't, maybe the people he got to build it were Masons. So now maybe it has a Masonic. So our Masonic tie. Now get this. Now there was a Danish researcher recently named Jorgen Samuelsen. And he was speaking to the Newport Historical Society, and he believes this, that the tower appears to have long-veiled Masonic roots that could invoke a Dan Brown-style mystery, he says, more than a rampaging Norseman on a transatlantic road trip. This is what he told the audience. Here's a quote. I risk my neck by saying there is a huge probability that this tower, the Newport Tower, was newly built in 1750. Now, circumstantial evidence, he says, points towards the fledgling Freemason movement in Rhode Island and a well-connected English-trained architect who found work among the rich and famous in the colonial Newport. The architect, Peter Harrison. Now, he was the person that laid out the octagonal summer home in the mid-1700s for Abraham Rosewood. Rosewood was a wealthy Newport merchant. The geometric form, they say, that Samuelsen goes on to say, closely associated with the Freemasons, is mimicked in the eight pillars of the tower and a little more than a block away.
That's so interesting.
It is. Now, the tower grounds, according to Samuelsen, could have been a Masonic, what he says is a Masonic garden, where the fraternity conducted its rituals. And like I told you before, there was carbon-14 dating. He had it done again on the mortar in the tower's mortar points. And it all says 1740 to 1810 are the most likely periods of construction. And he says that that result, coupled with Harrison's exposure to the octagon designed in England and the founding of a Masonic lodge in Newport in 1749, is pretty much where you can lay the theory out to where that's where it can stand on its own feet. He said if the tower had been built earlier, somebody would have left something in the ground. And like we discussed, they haven't found anything in the ground other than something colonial. And he goes on to say this. This is an old Danish saying. And this is his quote. It says, the truth is in the earth. The soil doesn't lie.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this has helped anyone's ideas or if it's opened up more. I'm really torn. Okay. I'm still torn behind this whole thing because, like I said, I had parroted things that I had heard.
I've always heard that there's always an argument as to not just when it was built, but who the heck built it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these different claims. I mean, that's what's so crazy to me is how can there be this many different people that they're claiming to have built this thing? Mm-hmm. From Chinese to Portuguese to Norse to Celts to just colonial Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it bears astrological alignments. But there are things in other parts of the world that lay claim to have knowing about this tower earlier than the 1700s. Now, my only question is with all those claims is I haven't looked into those claims enough.
Exactly.
But did they really say 500 years before the colonial America, there were still people talking about this tower? Or were they talking about something else? And people have said, well, they must have been talking about the Newport Tower.
I'm sure that's a possibility.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I've read all these crazy accounts.
Well, and the reason that I'm torn because of this, and like I love the idea more than anything of pre-Columbian visitation, and I think there's more than enough evidence to show that it's gone down. And it's also, this tower was kind of one of those romantic ideas for me, of this tower up there. But I can say, though, this the 100% honesty, that I believe what the evidence shows me, because I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't want to sit here and bitch that other trained archaeologists and researchers go to the sites like Göbekli Tepe or and they don't trust in what the evidence shows them. So I have to believe at this point what the evidence has shown me. And the evidence has shown me that it was built in colonial times. It doesn't answer all the questions that you just brought up. It doesn't answer, but the Masonic ties start answering a few more of those questions. I don't know. But from right now, I have to believe, like we talked about, you can't go into something with your mind made up and look for evidence to support that. You just have to walk into it and see what it leads. And if they've done that much of an archaeological dig and not found anything, nothing older than that, and it's undisturbed,
yeah,
then you kind of have to go, man, unless those guys were really, really good at picking up their tools.
Yeah.
And maybe they were. Maybe this is just one of those anomalies that maybe only two people built it. Maybe it wasn't a whole group of 300 or 400 people. Maybe it was two men built this entire thing, and they didn't drop anything. You know, maybe there's a few stone shards and all that. Maybe the stuff that they, who knows? I mean, it's still, there's always that possibility. You can't say, you can say 95, 98%, even 99, but you can't know for sure because we don't have a documentation of it.
I agree. Have you ever heard of the, one of the reported builders was of Prince Madoc? Have you ever heard of that theory?
Yeah, I did.
Now, one of these more popular legends of colonial America was that of Prince Madoc. Now, if you don't know who Prince Madoc was, he's a Welshman. He's from Wales. And he supposedly sailed from Wales in 1170, perhaps becoming one of the first Europeans to ever come to America. Now, the story with Madoc goes that his father was Owen Gwynedd of Wales, and that he wasn't a very good leader, and he was always fighting with his military cabinet and his cohorts and other successors. And having no desire to be a part of all the fighting, Madoc decided that he was just going to make a life for himself doing some exploring. So he set his mind on sailing west across the ocean with a small fleet of ships. Now, he was uncertain whether or not where he was going to go. It's uncertain whether or not he knew where the heck he was going. In other words, did he have any maps? Did he talk to fellow sailors?
I got you.
Did he have any idea? And, you know, this is a common thing when it talks, even when it comes to Christopher Columbus. They always want to make you believe that they just set sail not knowing what was going to happen. They thought that the world was flat and that it ended and that they'd fall off the, you know, the edge. But that's not really true.
Yeah,
everybody
exactly
knows now that, you know, they had a pretty good idea of where they were going. There was even, you know, maps that might have lost. We've talked about the Prairie Rees map. There's been other maps that have been found that show that, look, their coastline was well documented. And they didn't just go sailing across the middle of the ocean. They kind of followed the coastline.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Anyways, if it's true, and this Prince Madoc did set sail, well, they know that he set sail in 1170, but if he had found the New World, if that part of the story is true, then he could have discovered America a whole 342 years before Columbus, which, you know, again, we know the Celts have been here, the Norse have been here, the Minoans have been here. We know about the copper mining in Isle Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, after he made this reported trip to the United States, he loved it. He liked it. So he decided to sail back home. And when he returned to Wales, he started telling everybody about this place he found. It probably could have been the same place, you know, as Vinland, as the Norse described it. And he started trying to recruit more people because when he returned home, his father was still fighting. There was people fighting. His siblings were fighting, all for the throne. You know, I'm the prince, I'm the duke, whatever. He still didn't want any part of it. So he started going around trying to recruit new men to join him because he's like, I'm going back to this new land I found. And he knew that he needed a bunch of men because it would have made the chances for survival better, the greater the number of people you had with you.
Exactly.
You know, whether it's talking about the procurement of water, building structures, hunting, farming, even sailing itself, it would be more easily done with the more men and women you could get to go with you. And so that's what he did. He recruited a lot of people. They agreed, and they set sail again. And they never saw Prince Madoc again. No one ever saw him again.
That was it, huh?
Well, they think that he, you know, lived out his days in America. And there's been stories all over. It's even disputed as to where he landed in America. One of them is, of course, Rhode Island, where they think that the Newport mm-hmm. Tower was, and that he might have been responsible for building it. There's been stories even that he sailed all the way to Mobile, Alabama. There's been all up and down the eastern coast. They've reported him to have landed in Florida, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Virginia, even other places in the Caribbean. Now, one of the main ideas, though, is that he probably did land somewhere near the Mississippi River, where it comes into the Gulf of Mexico, by New Orleans and things like that, and that he sailed up the Mississippi River and built structures along the way, like he would stay here for some time, build a little structure, a little village or whatever, then move on up, and that at some point he ran into the Native Americans. and that him and his men actually assimilated into this tribe. The men became married. They interbred with the Indians. And the reason that they think all this happened is there's one particular tribe. Now, we may have given mention of this before on an Elite show. Have you ever heard of the Mandan Indians?
Yep, I remember us talking about this.
Okay. If you're not familiar with the Mandans were a tribe, and they were along the Mississippi River. Most of them settled in the Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio River Valley. And these Indians had one strange thing that was unlike all the other Native Americans. They were very light-skinned. They were reported to some of them have blonde hair, and a lot of them had blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in addition to this, many of the native words that the Mandan tribe used are the exact same words in Welsh. So how would that happen other than this?
Bunch of Welsh taking maybe some Native American brides and starting their own tribe.
Exactly. So Prince Madoc and his Welsh countrymen
could happen.
Moved in, they went up the Mississippi River, and they assimilated into this tribe. Now,
they may have started their own. I mean, they may have all stayed in one group together and all took Native American wives.
That's exactly right. Let's listen to this clip.
Wales, 1150 AD, 342 years before Columbus. In Snowdonia, Wales, Prince Madoc Ab Gwynedd Gwynedd is born. Legend says 20 years later, he set sail from Mosonsea in search of land to call his own.
The legend of him leaving from here to go to America originated in mythology, in a way the story was handed down from generation to generation.
The idea that Madoc discovered America didn't become part of the legend until the mid-1500s. Its sudden inclusion came at a time when Queen Elizabeth was trying to prove the British, not the Spanish, made it to America first. Today, the legend has grown even more. Some believe Madoc and a party of colonists left Wales in 1170 on a ship called the Gwenin Gorn and sailed all the way to Mobile Bay, Alabama. Madoc also gets credit from the locals for this site in Fort Mountain, Georgia. Legends of the Cherokee natives in the area say blonde-haired, moon-eyed people built it, although accepted archaeology suggests the natives themselves are responsible. Whether or not Madoc made contact with the Cherokee, his Welsh party is most often associated with a different tribe. The Mandan tribe originated in the Ohio River Valley. If Madoc's Welsh party continued traveling northwest from the Fort Mountain site in Georgia, the two groups could have met. While DNA testing of Mandan blood could be valuable in determining if there is a Welsh connection, it's not possible. In 1837, a smallpox epidemic wiped out all but about 150 of the 1,600-member tribe. And today, there are no full-blood Mandans left to test.
Yeah, see? So right there. I mean, these stories emerged amongst all the colonists at that time that there was these Mandan Indians and that these were the descendants of Prince Madoc. Now, one historian named Reuben T. Durrett said that the Madoc tale was especially popular among early settlers of Kentucky. And they would often tell the stories of Prince Madoc on long winter nights, even though it's not really sure if he ever really made it that far up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Falls, which is an area of Ohio, became especially connected with Madoc because here was the area where these Mandans supposedly lived and that they had taken on Prince Madoc's men and that they began to share cultures with these people. And there was a large burial ground that was found on the north side of the Ohio River. And what's crazy is one of these earthen fortifications was known as the Devil's Backbone. Now, they claim that this was Native American built, but a lot of people are saying, well, you know, Native Americans never really built a structure like this before. They're not known to build these, you know, what appeared to be a fort out of stone.
You
know,
they
never really did that before. So why would they all of a sudden start building structures like this? Unless it was, you know, these Welsh men that mm-hmm. were like telling them, this is the way we need to do it. Look, this is a better way of construction. And to me, that makes the most sense. I think that he did make it that far. In 1799, there were six skeletons found near Jeffersonville, Indiana. Check this out. Each skeleton was said to have been encased in a brass breastplate, which was emblazoned with the Welsh coat of arms on it. So some are saying that this could have been Prince Madoc and some of his men. Others say that this could have been found by Native Americans and that they had worn it and then had found its way up there. People had traded. You know, because you imagine if you had a bronze chest plate, you probably would trade. It could change hands time and time again because it was just unlike anything else.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But, you know, what is that? So I think that Prince Madoc did that. I think that him and his men came over. He found a good area. He went back home, told some of his friends. It'd be like if I had done it and I found a really good fishing spot. And I came back and I'm like, look, Cam, look, Travis, look.
But you wouldn't tell us about a really good fishing spot.
No, I wouldn't. No. But that's what this Prince Madoc did. And then he went over and he lived the rest of his days. Now, the thing that I find questionable, and the reason I bring this up, is to me there's no doubt that he intermarried with these Mandan Indians. But the fact that they're claiming that he could have been responsible for the Newport Tower, I don't know how there's any connection there. Because just because he could come over, what other ties mean that he was responsible for building that? You know what I'm saying? Maybe he was responsible for building, the American Stonehenge. Maybe he was responsible for building all these cairns that are all throughout the Northeast. Maybe he was responsible for building the structures at Cahokia. I mean, you can't just say because you have a theory that he had come over.
That he's responsible for all this other stuff.
Newport Tower. And, and the more I searched for Prince Madoc and the Newport Tower, I really couldn't find any connection.
Yeah.
There's numerous websites that give the connection, but there's no substance to it.
They don't have, I know exactly what you mean, It's a romantic idea.
It's a romantic idea.
I mean, look, it's a romantic idea that he sailed back off to America because he didn't have anything, he didn't like anything that was going on in his home country, and he lived happily ever after. That's a beautiful idea. Reality is, he either drowned at sea, if he was a real person, if this was all true, he either drowned at sea coming back to America, or he was murdered over here. After he got over here and he was messing around with some natives he shouldn't have been messing around with, and they cleaved his skull in.
Well, they were murdered. In fact, almost all the Mandans were murdered. The other Native Americans did not like the lighter-skinned Mandan tribe, and they went to a battle, and they were almost all murdered. And in fact, today, there are no longer any 100% Mandans left. So you can't even DNA test them and get a pure sample because it's already bred out of them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Look, it's a romantic idea.
Exactly. Is it?
But is there any substance? It's hard to say. I mean, we've covered it before, and like we've talked about the stories and stuff has been written about them. So we know that they were a real tribe. And we can only go off of what those people said that studied them. And they said that they were blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and basically spoke a type of Welsh language. There's only one other way. You don't just learn that. I mean, you know what? You don't just... What's the odds of that happening?
What was the name of the tribe that I think Frank Joseph or maybe Rick Osmond was telling us that had the words in Egyptian?
Yeah, there's some of
that. And they tried to play
that
off that like a priest or something had taught them
those words.
Yeah, and you're like, what are you talking about? Why would you teach Native Americans Egyptian?
Right, exactly.
It doesn't make any sense. The reason it doesn't make any sense is because it's absolutely not true. You know, we need to have Rick back on.
Yeah.
Because he knows a lot about these Mandans.
And we'll have to get him on and come talk about it because it's interesting. Well, folks, I hope that helped you because, like I said, we've been guilty of it. Kyle and I both been guilty of it about talking about things we know nothing about. That was something that was fun. It's something we wanted to really dig into and look into and try to catch a few things about. Maybe it'll help kind of sharpen you up. So if your friends start coming after you about something, you'd be like, no, listen here. This is this or this is that. So, yeah, before you pull a me and start parroting things that you really don't know a lot about, look into it. I mean, we all make those mistakes. Just take a quick, time, take an hour or so out of your day and look into something like that. That's what I had to do. I had to jump into it, like I said, because I was talking out of my butt. So.
Yeah, the Newport Tower is really interesting.
Yeah.
I love the fact that we don't know really who built it and all the surrounding things. And I also like to bring up, they always laid claim to these, they absolutely had astrological knowledge. Therefore, they must have been really smart. Were they really? I mean, I'm not saying that they weren't smart, but is it that magical? You know, you're talking about a time before television. Maybe everybody knew that this star aligned here and on the winter solstice it does here. I mean, maybe it was just as normal as anything.
Like a common knowledge type thing.
Yeah, maybe it's not so. I mean, we lay a lot of prestige to that, but maybe it's not something that bears that.
Well, because most people don't realize that the calendar year that we have starting over in January is not what everybody went by.
Absolutely.
They went by the summer and winter solstice. That's what it originally was. It didn't change until we've adopted this calendar system and all that. I mean, that's where the term April Fools came from. That's where these things started from. So you're right. Maybe more people knew that. Maybe more people that was something that was almost common knowledge, something that was may have been taught. We already know that knowing directions, your north, south, your east, your west, knowing how to move your way through there, that was something that had to be taught from when you were a child, because that's the only way you traveled. It's not like you had your TomTom or your phone out and you're driving down an interstate with all these signs. You're walking through the woods.
Yeah.
You're walking across prairies. I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere if you're going anywhere. So you kind of had to know that. So maybe you're right. Maybe it wasn't quite as difficult as what we make it out to be today, just because it's hard for us.
It's hard for us to understand that, because that's not the way we were raised.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Maybe back then it was common knowledge. Everybody knew.
Yeah, I think you're
every
right.
Every child older than 10 years old knew exactly how to set something up that would align with the winter or summer solstice or things like that. Maybe it's not so magical.
Yeah, maybe.
As we always pretended to be.
Yeah.
Anyways, interesting stuff. Let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed the Newport Tower. Don't forget, like you heard during the break, the Paradigm Symposium is coming up. Me and Cam are going to be there. You can call now and get your discounted tickets. 20% off if you call this number, 651-468-8115. You can go to the website, paradigmsymposium.com. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Cam, speaking of fun and funny, did you see this? A Florida man.
Oh, God, here we go.
He broke into a house. He stole a TV, Xbox, Cool Ranch Doritos, a bottle of Gatorade, and half of a Subway sandwich.
Well, he wasn't a bad guy. He left the other half.
That's right. He only stole half. That's right. Braxton Morgan is the guy's name. This took place in Sarasota, Florida. They said that he was able to go into a house, break through the back glass, go in there, and he stole a DVD player, an Xbox One, an Xbox 360, a Kindle Fire, controllers, an HDMI cord, some wine, along with the Doritos and a bottle of Gatorade and half of a sandwich. Of course, the teenager saw the guy breaking in, called the cops, and he was arrested. You know, that just never ceases to amaze me why the people do the things they do, and it seems to always happen in Florida.
It's like it's a different world. There's a veil around that part of the world, and you go into it. It's craziness. It's total madness.
It is really crazy.
I got something I'm going to let you folks know we're in the works with right now. If it all goes well, next Monday's show, folks, we're going to be talking to Joshua Cutchin.
Oh, yeah.
About his book, A Trojan Feast. And I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it. This is about the food and things, the food and drink offerings, basically, of here's right on the cover. Why am I reading this? The food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch.
It's a very interesting book. Like I talked about before, I've mentioned it before. Very rarely do I get a book on a subject that no one's ever really talked about. And I think it's fascinating. I can't wait to talk to him about it.
Yeah.
It's really peculiar that all these legends, they're kind of associate themselves with the same thing going on with these fae folk. Don't accept the food. You know, it makes me think of the missing 411 stories where these kids, they'll find the kids. And when they do, they're almost in a drowsy state, like they've been put under some kind of hypnosis or something. Right? I mean, it's a common occurrence.
It is. Yeah. Well, I just like it because it's a completely different angle of any book written.
Yeah.
And he's a handsome bastard, big square-jawed son of a gun, too. Yeah, look at him.
He looks like he'd be tough to wrestle with.
That ain't no joke, yeah.
Did you enjoy the Eddie Bravo invitation?
Oh, the EBI-4 was amazing. It was great, folks. For those of you that are, of course, not into grappling, this weekend was a really good grappling tournament put on by Mr. Eddie Bravo, a friend of ours. It was a great show. It was a really good show. So
yeah, very interesting. All right, folks. Well, don't forget, you can always listen to more of us. Me and Cam, that is, Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the top right Elite tab. You'll see it there, and you can sign up. Signing up is easy. You can email the show with your thoughts or your own stories, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, any of those. Cam, besides working out and doing your laundry, is there anything special that you got going on this week?
No, nothing. Trying to just get through this heat, baby. Trying to just pound this one out and keep moving forward.
I got a short week. Me and the family, we're driving down to San Antonio. We're going to have some fun down there.
That's right. Yeah, you son of a gun. Right? I've been thinking about you while you're down there horsing around.
All right. So everybody else, we'll speak to you Elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday with Joshua Cutchin. Cam?
Peace!